his court case. He's got a retrial for the whole thing from Philly. Interesting story. I think I have my stuff lined up. I'm going to the other morning show woman of community and Pacifica Radio, Sonali Kulhatar. Amy Goodman did some really great stuff this week. If you haven't heard the stuff about the Australian journalist in Afghanistan and the expose at The Intercept, you should go check that out. It's pretty amazing. It's not having any impact on the discourse in the U.S., of course. All right, Rise Up. She's got a conversation with a woman I've heard through the years in various guises about the leaving of Barr. The Injustice Department Attorney General Barr is leaving between Christmas and New Year's. Didn't quite lie enough. Okay, TaxCast. TaxCast has a very interesting document. It's a monthly. I like to return to some of the basic things. And they have episode 7 of transaction tax. So I gather they've been returning to this subject for quite a while. I don't know if I've heard or played earlier segments. I know I played at least one because I got some response. It's about time that hyperactive stock market with nanosecond exchanges of computerized programs get taxed just to slow them down, if nothing else, make a lot of revenue. Probably play it tomorrow because I edited out a Kenyan guy. Kenya has a transaction tax. Can you believe it? The EU has a mild one. I guess the UK has had one historically to run the City of London, and New York has had one for the stock exchange, but they don't collect the money. They said, we didn't really want to pass this. So, but there's a move in the U.S. to have that. Amy Goodman's got a piece on climate change. I am going to play something from Prison Radio. This is a 3-minute piece from a shorter report from Eric Reddick. The preoccupation I've been having with COVID in prisons. The vector that the U.S. has in its cultural milieu being having more people in prison and more prison guards than anywhere else in the world, and the kind of vector for transmission that is part of the problem we're having, I guess you might say. So here's a commentary. He speaks in a dialect, but it's understandable. I haven't gone and listened to the full 14 minutes version of this, where he lines out even more stuff about SCI Chester. I guess that's a federal penitentiary in Pennsylvania. Last week, if you didn't tune in, I had a piece from The Intercept, a woman who's been following the death penalty story and the acceleration that the bar attorney general has engineered. The only thing he can do to please Trump right now is burn some more people, three in the week leading up to MLK Day. I guess one of them is a white woman, apparently. And over in a lot of things to talk about. I've been having an ongoing argument about COVID. The positivity rating is in Illinois, I think it is, or is it in our district, is dropping to 8%, which means it's been as high as 10, I think. If you go out on the street and don't see many people, that's good. But 1 out of 10 people you run might be a carrier of some virulence or another. It's a very sobering circumstance. And people still are in denial about it. They should opt out of treatment, I think, if they're in spreading denialism and quietism about it, the COVID. All right. Here's a report from SCI Chester.
This is Eric Riddick calling from SCI Chester.
How did we go from no cases in 1 week, hundreds of cases, and people dying? There's a guy named Ponzo on life support right now, a lieutenant that worked here named Quintina, He died for 4 minutes, and they brought him back. He got to learn how to talk and all that. His officers is upset because they was wondering, why would you bring people from different jails to this institution? Men like Dennis McAhone, who they just diagnosed with cancer again. He has sugar diabetes, high blood pressure, every other ailment. He's frail. He can't even walk up and down the steps. He's over here. Boy, Francis Boy, he got a pacemaker. He can't even walk 5 steps without his chest hurting. He has high blood pressure. On and on, Jeffrey Johnson, James Kennedy, James Sanders, Mike Rinaldi, and multiple other elders over here that have underlying issues. Before the pandemic hit up here, we didn't have no cases, especially on CB. And if you look at what changed, a policy was violated when they moved first. They moved 100 and something people from other infected jails down here. First violation of the basic pandemic handbook guidelines, stop all movement. That was disregarded and violated. As a result, you know what I mean, trace contact was nullified. Show me the justification for violating the CDC mandate, the DOC pandemic handbook mandates, and common sense mandates. If you're going to implement a policy saying we can't go out in the yard because you can't mix cohorts more than 4 cells at a time, then how can you say that and then move 20, 30 people from a different part of jail onto a unit where all of your elders with underlying issues is housed? In the midst of the second wave, there's no justification for a rogue move. No doubt it's going to take the lives of some of these inmates that have these severe underlying conditions, right? Especially on this block. Don't give these elders that have these severe medical problems no goddamn felony and kill these individuals unconsciously or incompetently, whether you have malice involved or not. Dead is dead is dead is dead. I know the men in prison is incarcerated, some guilty of crime, but do that justify disregarding their health? If it does, then say it. And then we don't have no complaints. We don't have no grievance. But if not, then under the color of state law and in the spirit of care, custody, and control, make competent decisions that save lives instead of incompetent decisions that's taken lives, that have taken lives. All I'm saying is right now, they plan on moving inmates from other parts of the jail onto CB unit where all their elders with underlying issues is housed. Somebody call up here and please talk to Superintendent Kenny Eason and ask him to reconsider that move.
Eric Riddick calling from SEI Chester.
I guess that's Noel Hanrahan, who handles the work behind Prison Radio. I've been talking about playing some of the other commentaries. And that was a pretty moving one, it seems to me. Amy Goodman's got a piece on climate change. And I think I have it queued up right here. I'm going to try to get all of this on, as I usually do. I do have a lot of fulminations to make. I've just been called a know-it-all millennial by somebody on Facebook. I turned 70 last week. All right, well, maybe he thinks I'm acting like a know-it-all millennial. By the way, those biscuits and gravy you had at Apple Dumplings look like somebody already ate them. Okay.
Climate chaos amidst the pandemic, 5 years after Paris. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. It's been 5 years since the Paris Climate Agreement was signed, defining the entirely voluntary, unenforceable plan to avert global climate chaos.
We are still not going in the right direction.
That's United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking this week, addressing a forum marking the fifth anniversary of the climate accord. The meeting was held virtually due to the coronavirus pandemic.
Paris promised to limit temperature rise to as close as 1.5 degrees as possible. But the commitments made in Paris were far from enough to get there, and even those commitments are not being met. That is why today I call on all leaders worldwide to declare a state of climate emergency in their countries until carbon neutrality is reached.
World leaders, though, are primarily focused on a different state of emergency. With over 1.6 million people worldwide dead from COVID-19 and over 74 million cases reported, the suffering and economic devastation that the pandemic has caused disproportionately to poor people and people of color is inestimable. With President Donald Trump still at the helm, largely ignoring the crisis, the United States is faring worse than any other nation, with more than 300,000 deaths so far. Daily deaths are now topping 3,600, shattering global records. The CDC is projecting 83,000 Americans will die of COVID-19 in the next 3 weeks alone. Both catastrophes of the pandemic and the climate need to be dealt with immediately. A coalition of over 380 groups under the banner Build Back Fossil Free is demanding urgent action from President-elect Biden as soon as he takes office. Cassie Siegel from the Center for Biological Diversity said, quote, "Our house is ablaze with a fire fanned by Trump for 4 years. There's no time to lose. Biden must take bold action the moment he steps into the Oval Office without punting to a dysfunctional Congress," she said. The group is demanding a flurry of executive actions to overturn Trump's regulatory rollbacks as well as a green recovery. A genuine green recovery could spur investment towards a zero-carbon economy, renewable energy infrastructure, efficiency and conservation, while simultaneously addressing structural racism and inequality that cause poor people and people of color on the front lines and the fence lines of the climate crisis to bear the brunt of our addiction to fossil fuels. The United States is the greatest historical emitter of greenhouse gases, accounting for a quarter of the carbon dioxide emitted globally since 1751, has a moral responsibility to enact an aggressive green recovery and to support developing nations to do the same. With President-elect Joe Biden's defeat of Donald Trump, climate activists are hopeful. Biden's announced several nominations to positions central to pursuing his climate strategy. Former Secretary of State John Kerry has been named Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, handling climate diplomacy with a seat on the National Security Council. And former Environmental Protection Administrator Gina McCarthy will be the White House Climate Coordinator, charged with enacting domestic climate policies. Assisting McCarthy will be climate policy expert and Obama White House alum Ali Zaidi. Days before her appointment, McCarthy tweeted, "Every department in the Biden administration should be centering climate action and clean energy in their federal policies and investments to advance labor interests and environmental justice in communities across the country." Biden has also nominated Pete Buttigieg, the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and former Democratic presidential candidate, as Secretary of Transportation, responsible for regulating the most polluting sector of our economy. Former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, considered a strong advocate for renewable energy, has been nominated to head the Energy Department. And career environmentalist attorney Brenda Mallory will head the Council on Environmental Quality, which has a major role confronting environmental racism. "This is a big victory for our movement," Varshini Prakash, the executive director of the Sunrise Movement, which mobilizes youth climate action, said in a statement. She went on, "However, the true measure of Biden's commitment to tackling the climate crisis through an all-government, all-society mobilization is whether they'll be given the tools, power, and resources to be effective and push boldly towards 100% clean energy that raises the bar on environmental justice, job quality, wages, and benefits for workers," she said. Human-caused climate disruption is impacting the planet on an unprecedented scale, with one catastrophe after another, from extreme drought and wildfires, back-to-back hurricanes and typhoons, habitat loss and extinctions, all leaving death and destruction in their wake. Global heating also drives the emergence and spread of infectious diseases, virtually guaranteeing more pandemics like the one we're in now. These twin crises demand a global, collective, coordinated response with equitable, free distribution of coronavirus vaccines and therapeutics, and a vigorous, just, green recovery. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay, we'll get to the economics later. Transaction tax. There's a little discussion with Tax Justice Network, John Christensen, but more general topics too that I found intriguing. A little bit about Brexit. They haven't covered Brexit. They're pointing out that Boris was sort of depending on his boorish friend Trump winning and cutting a quick deal so that he wouldn't be at least as isolated as he claimed he wanted to be or something to that effect. So it's an interesting view from the UK. That'll be this next half hour. And, I didn't say anything about the cyber attack. I'm just roiling with it. I have no brief for the police state and the former Russia, et cetera, but a surveillance program, if that's a cyber attack, the NSA has been doing it for quite a while all over the world. Maybe I'll try and get something about that. It's just maddening to constantly calling it a cyber attack. I mean, now and again, but it's a drumbeat. It's surveillance. It's something the U.S. is, I guess they're just angry that they're not as good at it anymore. Actually, some of the tools that were leaked out of the NSA might be involved in this. I have no particular reason to say this, but big cache of NSA hacking tools was leaked out. No one really knows how, and it's been causing a lot of problems around the world. But I upbraided Dick Durbin, who's been particularly vicious. He says it's this cyber attack is an act of war or a declaration of war. Well, NSA has been doing it for quite a while, so the U.S. has declared war on the rest of the world. And maybe that's an accurate statement. I had to say that before Trump actually says something to that effect, because he's likely to be right, like they say about the clock having the right time every 12 hours or so. All right, do I have this one up? Yeah, this is, I can't find the document on my podcast. I rely on that to give the information. She'll do a great introduction. I've heard this woman interviewed here by Sonali Kalatar quite a few years, maybe when she was with Planned Parenthood, I'm not quite sure. But I find her quite incisive, and I'm going to play her right now from Rising Up.
Climate chaos amidst the pandemic, 5 years after.
That's the other one, huh? Okay. This should be the right item. Well, happened last week too. I've got an empty file here, apparently. I guess it didn't make this. So plan B is to go to TextCast first, and I'll get the Rising Up segment for this last 20 minutes or so. I'm rather agitated here.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. Make sure you never miss an episode and ping me an email on naomi@taxjustice.net and tell me what you think about the show. Coming up later.
That's a brilliant, easily collected tax. Doesn't cause any pain to investors. I mean, there are damn few alternatives. Do you want us to really just fire all the state workers, shutting down schools and laying off teachers? You know, how do you get Wall Street to pay its fair share here?
We take a look at the transformative power of financial transactions taxes. There's a chance that New York, home to two of the world's largest stock exchanges, could be about to set an important precedent. There's two bits of good news to share with you this month. In the United States, campaigners have been fighting to end secret company ownership for years and years. Enough politicians have now woken up to the fact that facilitating money laundering through financial secrecy is a national security threat. It means that now Congress has passed a defense bill which includes making corporations identify who owns and controls them. It also strengthens whistleblower protections. The bill has plenty of weaknesses, but it's an important step forward. And also, Portugal wants the European Union's Council of Member States to have a vote on public country-by-country reporting by multinationals. Portugal takes over the rotating presidency at the start of 2021. The European Union already has rules that make banks and the extractive sector do some reporting on their profits on a country-by-country basis, and the OECD publishes some data, but only for lots of companies all bundled up together. All eyes are now on Germany for this EU vote, which will need to switch its position from neutral to supporting, or for one of the other countries in opposition to switch. If the vote passes, it could be good news for the Global South in particular in being able to quantify how much tax big companies aren't paying in their countries, and for the public worldwide to know which companies and which countries are cheating the rest of us. Okay, let's talk to John Christensen now from the Tax Justice Network for his take on three major waves of change in 2020. The Black Lives Matter protests, Trump's departure from the White House, and the end of the Brexiteer's dream. OK, John, 2020 is a year most of us are glad to see the back of. The COVID pandemic has dominated everything this year, and we're not really going to talk about that very much today, but it has at least reconnected people with the idea that the state should be there to protect them and act in their interests. And it's all reconnected people with the idea tax is central to everything, right at the heart of everything, and things like universal public health care and all that sort of thing. After all, every second, the equivalent of one nurse's annual salary is lost to a tax haven. It takes decades for discontent, the type that we've seen in recent years, to boil over, and for politicians to exploit and misdirect people's anger. And the anger that Trump, for example, manipulated and the Brexiteers have manipulated has been building up for such a long time, going all the way back to at least Thatcher and Reagan. As Gramsci said, the old world is dying and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. We've had Bolsonaro, Orban, Trump, Johnson. How do you think historians are going to review these times that we're living through? As the age of monsters, the age of rule breakers? I mean, for decades, the powerful have been rigging economies in their favour. And this year, there's been some quite strong pushes back against that. Let's take a look at three major curveballs this year in 2020.
Well, I think you're absolutely right to ask this question about whether this is the age of monsters. And let's not forget that when Antonio Gramsci wrote that famous line about the age of monsters, he was being held in prison by the Italian fascist Benito Mussolini. And that was during a very similar period of turmoil after the stock market collapses in New York and in Europe. And the old era was dying, quite clearly dying, and capitalism had to be rebooted. And I think that's pretty much where we're at the moment, because neoliberalism has so clearly been dying for a long time now, and to all intents and purposes is now dead. Now, 2020, of course, has been particularly uncomfortable because the COVID pandemic has exposed how monstrous the leaders of some of the countries really are, especially in terms of their indifference to public health. I mean, Donald Trump and Jair Bolsonaro really stick out in this respect. And I think Trump especially sticks out because of his really weak handling of the murder of George Floyd and the way in which he handled the subsequent uprising of communities who were protesting against the persistent racism in the police forces in the US.
Right, and in the United States, there must be now an accountability process, a criminal justice process. And Biden, President-elect Biden, may be presenting a more diverse team on the surface, but he's going to need a diversity of professional experience. I mean, for example, reforming the criminal justice system, he's going to need a lot of criminal defence lawyers, not prosecutors, which is the tendency.
And the rallying of the Black Lives Matter movement around George Floyd's murder has brought people onto the streets right the way across the world, and it's opened up discussions around the legacies, including the legacies of slavery in so many countries. History is inevitably politicized in the interests of the powerful elites, and you can see why they'd want to close down any discussion around the legacy of slavery in many countries. But what Black Lives Matter has achieved is the opening up of a debate that has largely excluded the voices of the victims of slavery, colonialism, and the victims of imperialism. From an economist's perspective, this debate seems particularly important because students of economics, they seldom ever look at how power relations shape economic relations. But when you look at the rapid industrialization of the big imperialist powers in the 19th century and the 20th century, it's absolutely clear that much of the capital accumulated, all the wealth that was accumulated during that period, originated from the slave economies and from the weapons industries that protected those economies. The plundering of India and the plundering of most African countries, not to mention the entire continent of South America, deprived those regions of the capital resources they needed to invest in their own long-term development processes. And let's not forget also that the plundering didn't come to an end when the Wars of Independence forced the colonialists to retreat. Anyone who has watched the Spider's Web film, the subtitle is Britain's Second Empire, will know that the global rise of tax havens and the rigging of the rules for taxing multinational companies to favour the interests of European and North American countries, these have been crucial parts of the globalisation project pushed by Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. And historians have frankly only just started to explore the history of tax havens and how they have reinforced imperial power relations and created new forms of systemic injustice.
Right, and so much work to be done there. And so we've seen this year Trump defeated. It wasn't the blue wave that the Democrats had hoped for, but it's still historic in the sense that the nationalist, anti-democratic agenda for the radical right will take a hit, but not for long. And Democrats have got to be about much more than just opposing Trump, right? I mean, are the Democrats going to understand that these times call for radical measures on the climate emergency and fair distribution of wealth? Are they understanding that the United States must do what it's failed to do under many administrations and join in with global tax rules that really clamp down on unaccountable, untaxed wealth and profits, and start to get criminogenic corporates and finance companies under some kind of control?
Well, of course, that's something we'd all wish to happen, but it's important to bear in mind that despite Biden winning the popular vote by an astonishing 9 million or so votes, Donald Trump gained a record number of votes for any Republican contender for the presidency ever. So President-elect Biden needs to take really urgent action to address the underlying systemic causes of the deep division in the United States. And that will mean rewriting the rules that shape the way in which the pie, the economic pie, is divided between society. From a tax justice perspective, Biden needs to reverse the trend of the past 40 years towards cutting taxes on wealth and corporate profits. To begin with, he should simply scrap the 21% corporate income tax rate set by Trump in 2018. And he needs to reinstate the previous rate of 35%. I mean, he's been talking about 28 or so, but that's not ambitious enough. It needs to be back to 35%. And of course, very few large companies actually paid anything like that rate because of all the tax giveaways that have been accumulated over the last few decades. And these giveaways achieve little or nothing, so cut them out as well. But I don't think that Biden should stop there. Wall Street still earns fortunes from churning stocks and bonds and derivatives. So it's long overdue that the US applies a financial transaction tax, both as a mechanism for slowing down the churning process, but also for redistributing the revenue away from the speculators and into the public purse. And there are other measures that Biden could take at the domestic level to reduce extreme wealth inequality, introducing a wealth tax, for example, and other possibilities to introduce a carbon dividend to tax the big users of fossil fuels and redistribute the wealth to lower income households. And all of that could be done relatively easily. But of course, to do all of that effectively, he'll need to reinvest in the Internal Revenue Service, which has been badly depleted by the cuts imposed on it, not just by Trump, but also by his predecessor, Barack Obama. And we in the tax justice community should be watching carefully to see what action Biden takes to restore the capacity of the Internal Revenue Service. But when it comes to internationalism, Donald Trump took a wrecking ball to the existing order. And Biden is a self-proclaimed internationalist, and he'll need to take very strong measures to reverse that nationalist agenda. And for starters, he should sign the US up to the Common Reporting Standard for Automatic Information Exchange between tax authorities. The US has so far failed to sign up to that. And he can also promote the idea of country-by-country reporting by all US companies in all countries where they operate. That's just catching up with the rest of the world. Under Trump, the US has not played a positive role in shaping the OECD's base erosion profit-shifting discussions. And those discussions have stalled as a result of a lack of leadership. Now, the only way forward, which will lead to a durable and equitable framework for international taxation, lies with shifting away from the old arm's length method and adopting unitary taxation. And from my point of view, that might be the best test of Biden. Will he or will he not make the necessary break away from the old order to a new order based upon unitary taxation? And will he then also lead the way in establishing a minimum tax rate, and maybe aligned with the 35% tax rate that previously applied in the US, to block the race to the bottom political impulses of the people on the radical right? So there you have it, a number of tests that we can apply to a Biden government to see whether he is the progressive and the internationalist that we'd like him to be.
Right, well, we'll see, won't we? And if we cross the pond, on the one hand, so you've had the US electorate choosing a more internationalist president who sees the collective benefit of rules. And on the other hand, the UK is only 1 year into the absolute opposite ideology, trampling all over the rules in the name of so-called sovereignty, which we could call fake sovereignty. Brexit is just another attempt, exactly like Trump's brand of nationalism, to undermine rules-based global trading agreements, push a race to the bottom to the benefit of elites, not ordinary people. And at the Tax Justice Network, we've been talking about the importance of a level playing field for years. And the European Union does seem to see the danger in what the UK is trying to do and is pushing back against it. I can't help thinking that only the British, and well, it's really the English, only the English could leave a club, reserve the right to shit all over it, and then still demand the same rights that the club offers. And the European Union would be failing in its duty to its own citizens if it was going to allow a big trading partner right on its doorstep to drive down wages, working conditions, environmental standards, financial regulatory standards, and yet still give them access to the single market. I mean, it's not that the European Union is as pure as a driven snow here. It does protect its tax haven nation states, but it doesn't want an extreme rule-breaking agenda that the Brexiteers want. So now we've got Britain very isolated. Trump has gone. Its rule-breaking partner in crime is no longer there. Doesn't have many friends left, which I guess is what happens to neighbours from hell, eventually, all of them.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens to neighbours from hell. Now, while we don't yet know what the final outcome will be for the latest round of Brexit negotiations, the Brits are determined to stick to a radical right-wing agenda, which will allow access to the single market while still making it possible for the radical right conservatives in Boris Johnson's cabinet to degrade worker protections, erode social protections, and do little or nothing to protect the environment. And that's their project. But the Europeans, on the other hand, have been totally resolute in protecting the integrity of the single market and resisting Johnson's race to the bottom. And as everyone knows, Johnson was politically aligned with the Trump project and was hoping that a quick and dirty trade deal with the US might provide political support for the kind of Singapore on the Thames economic model that he and his cabinet have in mind. Deregulated, low tax, you know, a very right-wing agenda. But it seems unlikely that Biden will play along with this project, which leaves Johnson facing the European Union negotiators, who, despite all his attempts at dividing and rule, apparently remain totally united. And that's not what he expected. So here we are, days away from the end of the Brexit transition. Trucks have already started to back up over many, many kilometres on both sides of the EU and the UK border. And the free traders who push the Brexit project might well end up with a no deal, which introduces tariffs where previously there were no tariffs, and which might lead to a whole raft of new customs paperwork when previously goods and services could flow freely between Europe and the European Union countries. The Brexit project was to break the European Union's resolve, to break the whole project of trying to create an international rules-based trading order. In other words, to create a kind of globalization where there were no rules, no frameworks for cooperation. And that project has failed.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Many nations across the world have been hit hard by COVID, and they need to salvage their financial situations fast. And COVID has highlighted even more all the underlying historical reasons for who's on top in our world and who isn't. We know things like wealth taxes and excess profit taxes are part of the solution, but what about our historically undertaxed finance sectors that sit right at the top of the tree? This month, the TaxCast looks at financial transaction taxes.
Well, New York, as you know, is about 20 million people. This year, it got hit very hard by the COVID epidemic.
This is Jim Henry speaking from New York. He's an economist, lawyer, and Tax Justice Network senior advisor.
We had an enormous surge in fatalities and hospitals were filled up. And so I think New York is pretty severely impacted. We've had a real surge in unemployment. So states and municipalities are facing big deficits. New York's looking at a $60 billion deficit over the next 2 years, which is a substantial. It's the largest deficit it's ever had. They're looking at laying off thousands of state employees and reducing investments in things like the transit system, basically talking about a 20% reduction in services. So this has increased pressure on state and local governments to look at alternative sources of revenues. And that's where the topic of the financial transactions tax comes in, because New York is the home to two of the world's largest stock exchanges, the NASDAQ, NASDQ, and the New York Stock Exchange. And together they account for roughly 40 to 50% of all the transactions on stock markets in the entire world. This year it's been on the average something like $4 to $5 trillion a month of stock trades have gone on these two New York exchanges.
It's well worth asking, isn't it, to whose benefit this high volume of exchanges is. As TaxCasters will know, high levels of financial transactions aren't necessarily a measure of productivity or investment in anything useful.
Yeah. What's happened on Wall Street in the last couple of years is just amazing in terms of the volumes of really speculative transactions. You know, the stock exchange has turned into kind of a casino. It's always been a bit of a casino, but you have something called high frequency trading. The average trade lasts 10 seconds and accounts for 70 to 80% of volumes. And it's just simply firms that specialize in arbitrage that are sort of rushing a whole river of transactions through these exchanges that are purely speculative. And financial transactions are enormous, but if you put a tiny tax, nobody will notice.
No one would notice. But the finance sector hates the very idea of it, because they know once that door opens a crack and the fairness of it and the ease of collection is clear, that door will never close again, and it could open even wider. And they also know a financial transactions tax isn't only about raising revenue, it's about transparency around transactions, slowing them down and discouraging economically damaging transactions. Back to Jim Henry in New York now, where he's been working with local politicians and other campaigners, teachers and nurses unions to get enough backing for a financial transactions tax bill in New York State.
New York actually first adopted a financial transactions tax of its own in 1905, and that tax is still on the books. It's called the stock transfer tax. It's a tiny tax. It's about 5 cents. It's a nickel per $100 in the U.S. But with the transactions running at $5 trillion a month, that's enough to generate as much as $4 to $5 billion in taxes, depending on the month. You know, on average, probably around $2 billion of tax revenue to New York State.
Thanks to bank lobbying, they stopped that tax dead in its tracks since 1981. It's just a 0.03% tax on all stock trades on the NASDAQ New York Stock Exchange. Reintroducing just this modest tax would set a powerful precedent for finance sectors everywhere, which, after all, have been raging relatively unchecked for so long. Campaigners in New York State now think they have enough support to get a vote on it and pass it. And really, New York State should be passing a more ambitious financial transactions tax. But this is just the beginning.
We're talking about a 0.1% tax, a dime per $100 of shares. And that's just not going to affect anyone. And, you know, all the economists in the world basically agree on this. It's a brilliant, easily collected tax. Doesn't cause any pain to investors. Wall Street, or the billionaires on Wall Street, have seen a $1 trillion increase in their net worth since March, because of the impact of the pandemic on the stock value of companies like Amazon. You know, so those folks are not hurting. I mean, there are damn few alternatives. Do you want us to really just fire all the state workers, shutting down schools and laying off teachers and fire people? And, you know, how do you get Wall Street to pay its fair share here?
In the European Union, talks are resuming on the long-proposed EU-wide financial transactions tax, a 0.1% tax rate for transactions in all types of financial instruments, except for derivatives, which would be subject to a minimum 0.01% tax rate. Various lobbies had managed to quash the EU-wide attempt, leaving it just to individual member states to implement. But now the European Union's revisiting it as part of their COVID rescue budget they're trying to pass. And there are bigger questions to ask about going further than just tapping financial sectors for a few cents or pennies.
The free movement of international capital needs to be disrupted and dismantled as part of a reparations agenda. Defunding the financial markets through an iterative tax can provide a blueprint for building a post-capitalist world.
Economist Keval Bharadia spent 15 years working in London Stock Exchange. He's talking systems change. And his work demonstrates how transformational a financial transactions tax could be.
So how much money could be raised? The value of global capital flowing through financial markets is actually £28 trillion per day. That £28 trillion per day comes from both exchanges, like the London Stock Exchange, the New York Stock Exchange, the Amsterdam Stock Exchange, but it also comes from the over-the-counter trading done by the world's biggest investment banks, whose wealth can be traced directly back to enslavement and colonialism. Liberal campaigns for a financial transaction tax to date have not critically engaged with the financial market's intrinsic relationship with these issues. The tax could easily raise just by applying a 0.05% tax rate. Don't forget, VAT is charged at 20%. So if we just charge a 0.05% tax rate, we're looking at £14 billion per day to fund reparations and systems change. I've estimated how much that could be in the UK, which is around £500 million per day. That's over £100 billion per annum. And actually, these figures include exchange traded and over-the-counter markets. They also include the major asset classes traded across all financial markets, including equities, bonds, foreign exchange currencies, and commodities markets. And commodities markets are also large. That's where oil and gas is traded. Oil and gas that's plundered, metals that are plundered get traded through the commodities markets. And also with the rise of financialization, most financial markets trading is increasingly on paper without the need for these physical assets, but are still leveraging these physical assets. This number actually doesn't include the world's gold and silver exchange, which is based in London. They do not publish transparent data. So the world is far from poor. The tax over the longer term enables the transformation of global power relations and the dismantling of imperial capitalism that maintains poverty, inequalities, and ecocide.
It seems like the right time, you know, for everybody to get together and to have a kind of race to the top for the financial transactions tax. We could end up, I think, you know, in the not too distant future with quite a good success story here in New York.
We'll see how all that goes. Thanks for listening, and thanks for remaining with us throughout this year of turmoil. We'll be back with you next month. We're going to be kicking off 2021 with practical ways to fix and heal our world. Bye for now.
I was thinking about pulling up the scene from Young Frankenstein where the monster sings, putting on the Ritz, playing a little segment of that. It's pretty hilarious. Yeah, they have a whole series on reparations in the economy. They have this thing, and did you catch there was that Gramsci reference in there too at the beginning? They both took it up, comparing the times when the Italian fascists had put him in jail to sort of the economic disarray that we're in now. Speaking of economics, well, the labor, Radio Free Labor is coming up pretty straight away. I got to put a sock in it and play this segment. Inside Europe and Economic Update also fill out part of your afternoon with Weft, if you want to hang out. This Way Out is in the line, too. I don't know. That was on Saturday afternoons. Between the lines. I'm sorry. Kind of read these abbreviations. So, Rise Up with Sonali is what I promised, and we'll get to most of it. Maybe all of it. This is with this Fredrickson woman who was with Narrow, anti-abortion group. I think you might have heard her interviewed on Democracy Now! Or somewhere. She's well-spoken. And so is Sonali Kalatar, who we'll check out right now. Thanks for tuning in and support Different Views on the Radio. TaxCast, yeah, worth checking out going through their listings. I like the reparations aspect. They had that author who was speaking, whose name is pretty impronounceable for me, did a whole 40-page piece on the financial tax as a vehicle for funding reparations, not just internally, but through the despoilation of lesser developed countries. Call Walter Rodney's piece, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. Piece, it was a full book, right? And here we go.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Attorney General William Barr will leave office just before Christmas, as per a tweet by the president on Monday. For Barr to leave office barely a month before his slated departure indicates Donald Trump's displeasure with a man who has been one of his most loyal foot soldiers. While Barr has bent over backwards to fit U.S. law and ethical standards to Trump's needs, apparently overturning the election's results was a step too far, even for him. Trump had publicly chastised Barr for not supporting his demonstrably false claims of illegal voting. During his time as Attorney General, Mr. Barr made waves for acting more like the president's personal lawyer than the nation's top prosecutor. Joining me to discuss what he leaves behind at the DOJ is Caroline Fredrickson, distinguished visitor from practice at Georgetown University Law Center. She served as the president of the American Constitution Society from 2009 to 2019. She also served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and as general counsel and legal director of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Welcome to the program, Caroline.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
It was interesting to see that William Barr came into office because Jeff Sessions, his predecessor, was fired for not towing the Trump line. Sessions refused to recuse himself from the Mueller investigation, or rather insisted on recusing himself from the Mueller investigation, and Trump was pretty upset about that. Sessions left. Do you see Barr's departure as in the same vein of having displeased this dictatorial president, and so now he's out the door?
It's really ironic because, as you mentioned in the introduction, you know, Bill Barr has done everything possible to please this president. I mean, and let's face it, he was pleasing himself because he had an ideology that is extremely far to the right that believes that the president basically can do no wrong. The irony is that that he himself is going to be asked to pack his bags before the end of this term. He did go as far as anyone possibly could. But even Bill Barr couldn't manufacture evidence that didn't exist.
So let's talk about what marked him and his legacy. During the hearings for his Senate confirmation, the fact that he had essentially written an open letter to Trump, sort of vying for the job, and the fact that he had held these views about excessive executive power seemed to be sort of brushed under the rug. Even Democrats voted for him, I assume naively supposing that he wouldn't go as far as he said he wanted to go. So he came into office almost as an open book, and he did sort of end up playing out that ideology that people feared, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he laid it out, and he has a history, right? I mean, he was involved with the pardoning of the Iran-Contra criminals. He has long believed in this extremely, excessively broad vision of executive power, president as king, essentially. And he laid it out all in that letter to Donald Trump saying, you know, by definition, the president cannot obstruct justice. The Mueller investigation is wrongly, has no basis. I'm going to come in and I'm going to give you everything you want. And so it was all there. And it's really incomprehensible that the Democratic senators did not push on these issues because they weren't secret. They were there for anybody who bothered to ask about them. And Barr has lived up to all of the worst fears that anybody could have had about him.
Was Bill Barr the reason why Trump so successfully convinced so many Americans that the Mueller investigation completely exonerated him?
Absolutely. He was certainly one of the major architects of that argument by suppressing the full report from ever being seen, but even from suppressing Mueller's own synopsis from being publicly available until Barr had himself presented a version of it that was very misleading and shaped the coverage of the Mueller report thereafter, in which he essentially said there was no finding of obstruction and no finding of conspiracy with the Russians. It's not at all what the Mueller report said. The Mueller report said simply that it was the job of Congress because of the opinion written by the Office of Legal Counsel in which it says that basically a president can't be indicted while he's president, which we can contest, and I hope it will be changed. But so he was leaving it to Congress to make the decision on obstruction. On conspiracy, he lamented the big problem is conspiracy requires intent. And they never got an interview with Trump. And so while they had, so many contacts with the Russians and so much evidence about interactions that could have stood for a conspiracy charge, they didn't have the element of intent that's required for the proof. And that was really a devastating report from the perspective of Trump, had the people actually known what it said.
Then he also went on to exonerate so many of Trump's own allies and friends. The investigation against Michael Flynn was dropped. Roger Stone was let out of prison. Those were also basically gifts to Trump, right?
Right. And he intervened in a way that was so completely counter to the history of the Justice Department. And the idea is that the prosecutors are supposed to be following the evidence, bringing the charges, pursuing the prosecution. And they did that. And they were successful. And it was only after they got these convictions that Barr swoops in and undoes them. You know, after tweets by Donald Trump and a recognition that as servile as he is, that Barr would get better, you know, would be liked better and supported better by the president if he actually went in and committed this you know, very unprecedented act of undoing prosecutions by his own Department of Justice.
There's also the issue of William Barr's role in the Portland unrest. During this past year, we had seen this massive national uprising starting first in cities like Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed by police, spreading to cities like Seattle and Portland, New York City, Los Angeles. And William Barr, shouldn't we see as part of his legacy the unleashing of federal troops, armed federal troops on ordinary Americans? He did it in D.C. as well, in the nation's capital.
Well, absolutely, and more. You know, also as somebody who contests the idea that there is actually a problem with racism in America.
He said it in a hearing.
He contests the idea that there's any racism in policing, and that he set up a policing commission that had nobody on it except police, the law enforcement side, nobody from the civil rights community, nobody who suffered at the hands of brutal police officers. And so he not only allowed a president to be described in the media as completely innocent after a very thorough investigation by Bob Mueller that showed everything to the contrary, but also he has a legacy of bringing out force against peaceful protesters in America and really undermining the fight for racial justice. And it's hard to think of a worse attorney general. I thought when there was Jeff Sessions, that would be the rock bottom, but clearly there was lower to go.
Mm. So essentially acting as Trump's personal lawyer and then this so-called tough on crime approach, which he has then cemented by resuming the federal death penalty after years long effective moratorium. Bill Barr leaves office signing off on the executions of 5 death row inmates, 2 of whom have already been killed. This too should be part of his ugly legacy, right?
Oh, you know, it's hard to list all of the things. It really depresses me just to think through all of the things, in addition to, you know, the spurious arguments in favor of what they call religious liberty, which is really the ability to discriminate against Americans on the basis of their gender identity or their transgender or otherwise, and yet, you know, he claims himself to be a man of faith. He's willing to execute people at a fast clip and discriminate against other people. And you know, I just ask, where is the faith in that?
It's worth stopping to remind our audience and ourselves of what the DOJ and the role of Attorney General is supposed to be. I mean, under Trump, so much that simply was not tolerated before has become normalized. What would be, although a president appoints an Attorney General, what is supposed to be the relationship between a president and an Attorney General? Since Nixon, we haven't seen this much sort of politicization of that office, right?
Oh, well, indeed. And, you know, it is worth stepping back for a second to think about how it's constructed. You know, one of the things that Donald Trump's presidency has uncovered for so many of us, and not just in the area of the Department of Justice and its own internal processes, but more broadly, is the fact that we don't have a lot of legal limits on the president abusing the public trust. A lot of what we have been depending on are norms, are accepted ways of behaving. And unfortunately, a lot about the Department of Justice has been observed in that way. The president does appoint the attorney general. In other administrations, they've adopted internal rules that set very strict limits between political people and prosecutors in terms of what kinds of investigations and what prosecutions were appropriate to bring, so that you wouldn't have undue political influence on that part of the Department of Justice's work. Obviously, they do policy work as well, and there's going to be more engagement from the White House and from the political appointees in those areas. But in terms of the law enforcement side, that was supposed to be a pretty bright red line that separated the two. And when I did work in the White House, and there was a very high level policy that would bar any conversations between the White House and prosecutors over certain kinds of subjects. Well, now we know that there's no way to enforce that, that it was dependent on the White House itself and on the Department of Justice adopting and following an internal rule process. So there are many of us who've been engaged in conversations about what kind of reforms are necessary and how do we strengthen the independence of the Department of Justice. You know, some of them can be done through legislation. Some of it can be done through stronger congressional oversight, but some of it we may need to think about, you know, going forward if it's possible to make constitutional changes. I, for one, think that the Attorney General should be much more independent than is certainly has been the case under Donald Trump.
In addition to Barr refusing to go along with Trump's wild claims of illegal voter fraud, perhaps because there is no evidence of it, one of the other things that it seems has angered Trump was the fact that there has been this secret investigation, months-long investigation into Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, in some sort of tax investigation. And when Trump, when news of it was revealed, Trump apparently was deeply angry that that wasn't made public months ahead. And, you know, he didn't even try to sort of mince words when he made it clear that he would have loved to have politicized an investigation of Hunter Biden to his advantage ahead of the election. So I'm wondering if that too played a role in Trump essentially, you know, to fire your attorney general, which is effectively what it was, a firing a month before he's slated to leave. It's basically a slap in the face of William Barr. And I'm wondering if the Hunter Biden secret investigation was part of it.
No doubt. I mean, I'm sure there was a series of things that, you know, again, they're, you know, I think Bill Barr, you know, he saw what, you know, the writing on the wall in terms of the election. I mean, he did suggest that there could have been fraud. I mean, he played along with the president's craziness. But at the end of the day, there was nothing he could do to actually change the outcome. And I think once he saw that writing on the wall for him, you know, there's really no upside to further tarnishing, well, I wouldn't say his legacy, because his legacy is already so tarnished, but to adding, you know, fuel to that fire, where being fired is, you know, at this point, what's the big deal for him? He goes home, he spends the holidays with his family, and then, you know, and probably, as happens so often in D.C., he gets welcomed back into the elite legal community, whereas so many of us think he should be disbarred and run out of town. You know, the guy is practically a criminal himself for what he has done. But you know, as for him, I'm sure he's probably pretty pleased to be able to walk out now and not have to stick around for the last month of Looney Tunes out of the White House.
Right. There was a lot of talk among the legal community for impeaching Barr as Attorney General. And then you look at that resignation letter that Trump publicized that basically could have been written by Trump himself. Obsequious, cannot even begin to describe it. It clearly, Barr didn't go the way of John Bolton or General John Kelly, you know, one-time Trump loyalists who went out the door openly criticizing Trump. Barr is going out the door lauding Trump. He spent almost the entire letter praising everything Trump has done in the face of, you know, implacable resistance, relentless resistance. And it just was this love letter to Trump. Just, is it purely ideological for Bill Barr? I mean, he doesn't even seem to have much pride.
Well, Bill Barr got everything he wanted. So let's not forget that, you know, certainly he looks like a lapdog to Donald Trump, but he was very much in control in terms of achieving policy outcomes that he desired. He has always wanted to have a souped up superpower presidency with excessively strong powers. He helped give that to Donald Trump, expand the concept of executive power. He has supports the extreme right-wing judges that Donald Trump nominated. He was part of the Federalist Society in grooming these judges who are turning our law back at a rapid pace when it comes to civil rights and civil justice, not to mention criminal justice, environmental law, everything else you could think of. They're turning the clock back and denying Americans rights. There are a lot of things he's gonna say that he's really proud of, and so he can come out of there and say he got what he wanted. He really did.
That's Barr. No, that's talking about Barr, and that's Caroline Fredrickson. She's now with the Georgetown University Law Center, though, in the midst of the Beltway, where the Beltway bandits hang out. had been president of the American Constitutional Society. She's kind of inside the Beltway in a large way. She was with Pro-Choice America and the ACLU Washington legislation. And that was Sonali Kalantar rising up. I'm sorry, I talked too much earlier, like I'm talking too much now. And you can find the last minute and a half of that by going to Rising Up with Sonali, looking for Assessing William Barr's Disturbing Legacy. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station, in part or in toto. We like Toto. What did I leave out? WEFT, Champaign Urbana, listener-sponsored volunteer-operated radio. I'm caught in a groove here. I don't have my USB up, so